This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, and with me, Brian Fernandez. And we're coming up to the end of the week. It's been a slightly shorter week than usual, just 4 days, but still, I think, heavy for many of us who have as much work to do, whether it's 4 or 5 days.
Yes, you look a lot perkier despite the fact that it's a Friday, Sharad.
Yeah, I am feeling excited by the weekend, as I always do. And I think I share the same sentiment as most of the denizens of the Klang Valley who have a 5-day week. The weekend is something to look forward to. Now, as you slept, of course, so much has happened in the world. And just a quick rundown of some things that are both local and foreign that may be of interest to you. The huge hurricane Category 5 Irma has been creating devastation to the Caribbean. It's now headed to the islands of Turks and Caicos. They are preparing for the arrival. I believe already 10 people are reported dead in various islands off the Caribbean. It's heading towards the American mainland. Also in the news, New York-based Chinese property tycoon Guo Wenqi has applied for political asylum in the U.S. He previously had accused top People's Republic of China officials of corruption. He believes that he's now the target of political persecution. So that's also a big story.
Well, that's not the first time this has happened. I think there have been several instances like this where I think they've selectively gone after property tycoons in terms of prosecuting them. They've fallen out of favor. So it'll be interesting to watch the developments in this case.
Also, yesterday, a civil suit against the government and preacher Zakir Naik was postponed to September the 21st after a last-minute application by Putrajaya to strike it out. This suit comes from several Malaysian groups that feel that Zakir Naik is a televangelist, because he's a well-known Indian televangelist who's now in trouble in India, in trouble with the law in India, and saying that he's in fact a national security risk, or he's disruptive to Malaysia and would like to have him expunged from the nation. So that was a suit that happened yesterday. And the application, remember, it's been postponed to the 21st of September. Also in the news, Sabah Parks Director Jamili Nias is the first Malaysian selected to be a member of the prestigious International Union of Conservation of Nature World Heritage Panel. So kudos to both Mr. Jamili Nias, and also it's interesting that Sabah should be, somebody from Sabah and Sabah Parks should be selected.
And it's nice to see a Malaysian, I mean, being involved in conservation and being recognized for that as well. You know, the developing world is often associated with destruction of forestry and of nature and so forth. So yeah, it's really nice to see that someone, and as you said, from Sabah, being recognized for that, especially given the fact that thousands and thousands of hectares have been actually deforested to make way for oil palm plantations and for timber logging.
Yeah, and also I think Sabah is very famous for its marine parks, and there's some very large and very important marine parks in the state of Sabah established over the last couple of decades, including the Tun Sankaran Marine Park, also known as the Sampurna Islands Park, and several others, I believe, that were established. I think the more recent one was the Tun Abdul Rahman National Park, which comprises 5 islands, some 3 to 8 kilometers off Kota Kinabalu in Sabah, and is spread over 4,000, almost 5,000 hectares, which is extraordinary. You know, in its size.
So. And also, it's Sharad, again, I think we always talk about how Malaysia is really underappreciated. We don't appreciate the beauty that we have in our own country, and we see to go overseas to look at it. So, yeah, fantastic.
Okay, coming up, JJ Kale and Friday, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was JJ Kale. And Friday, which is very appropriate, of course, because it is Friday, the 8th of September. We're coming up to a little past 9 minutes past 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm sure I'd put in with me Brian Fernandez. Brian, a popular British retailer, John Lewis, said recently that it scrapped the girls and boys signs at its department store across the country. And this they did, in fact, last year, and has introduced a line of unisex baby wear. Its head of the children's section says the move is towards creating what they call gender neutrality at its stores with the aim of overcoming stereotypes. Now, this policy apparently has provoked a spirited debate on social media and elsewhere. Do you think, Brian, it would be possible to do such things here?
No, but if you look at baby wear, that's not really a shouldn't be a contentious issue, because if you look at these jumpsuits, and when my daughter was growing up and when she was a baby, all these jumpsuits, I kept thinking, hey, why is this gender specific? Yes, besides the fact that it's pink, why is a jumpsuit a girl's jumpsuit? A boy.
Why is pink a girl's color?
Exactly. So I didn't see any.
Come back to my initial question. Do you think it could be done here?
Yeah, of course. I think so.
Well, no, would there be any pushback on that?
There would be a pushback if you suddenly say that a skirt is unisex. I think that would be generally a pushback. But girls wearing jeans, shorts.
Girls have been wearing boys' clothes for the longest time.
Correct.
But the question is, does it work the other way around? I mean, so
I would have a problem with that.
So, but when a department store labels something unisex and say a skirt is unisex, and you know, it's not compelling you to buy anything. It's not suggesting that you buy the skirt for your boy children, is it?
No, it's not. But it does suggest that you can. And
what would be wrong with that? So if you can, you can.
You can, but the thing
what
is...
What is a sarong after all? I mean, sarong is also unisex, isn't it?
Yes, a sarong, I think, is a very unique garment. In a sense that I think, yeah, it is a unisex garment. But a skirt, somehow we've all been...
skirt, does it look a bit like a kilt?
Yes, it does. So if you ask a Scotsman, he would say, well, you know, that's my national...
And in fact, many Samoans wear, men wear things that look like skirts, don't they?
So do you think that I mean, we've been conditioned, of course, to look at a skirt as a female garment. But... I wouldn't want, for example, my son to wear a skirt. That's just not on. I mean, if I had a son, no, I wouldn't want him to wear a skirt. Definitely not.
Okay, because?
It's just not done.
Oh, it's not done here, you mean. Okay, so say if a retailer has this policy, that seems to be unique to them, you know, and it's a willing buyer, willing seller situation. So why the kerfuffle, do you think?
I think sometimes people are veering too much on the point of view that, you know, you've got to be politically correct. Everything has got to fit in, you know, and you shouldn't be stereotyping people.
But isn't that a good thing?
Sorry?
Isn't that a good thing?
Well, yes and no. Sometimes there's an... I think in this case, you've just gone too far. Making a little child, and with an example, protesting against clothes... I think that's really, the lady's just gone too far.
So you're referring to an article that we're reading here, in which there was a protest, and it was a protest by whom against whom?
Yeah, so basically, Asda came under criticism for selling T-shirts for boys and featuring slogans like "Future Scientist," while their T-shirts for girls proclaim "Hey Cutie" and "Ponies Rock." So last year, an 8-year-old British girl, Daisy Edmonds, became an internet sensation after her mother filmed her at a Tesco supermarket rallying against the T-shirts which she saw as sexist. And when why? Because she asked, did the boys' T-shirts say things like "Desert Adventure Awake" or "Think Outside the Box," while the girls' T-shirts said "Beautiful," "Hey," and "I Feel Fabulous"? So I think that, okay.
Well, I mean, you're the father of a young girl. Do you think gender stereotyping would limit your daughter? If, you know, if you have a society that says to your daughter, she shouldn't get involved in the hard sciences, that she could never aspire to be an astronaut, that all she should be aspiring to is playing with Barbie dolls and being pretty for some man to pick her up as a potential wife in later years. I mean, wouldn't you be upset?
So And the answer to that is absolutely yes, because she actually likes the hard sciences. And you use this child as an example, has been encouraged to read, has been encouraged to strive for whatever she wants to do. She wears jeans, she wears shorts. She climbs.
But nobody would suggest she's cross-dressing.
No, nobody at all. But I think of a boy, boy's mother who always wanted a girl, dressed him up in a dress and paraded him around KL. I think that there's going to be a lot of pushback from that.
From whom?
From, I think, people around. Just people around. And also, I think the boy would get some psychological trauma out of that because all the children would make fun of him.
This is probably true. I mean, in terms of a scenario that would develop, I would think you're absolutely right. The stereotypes are so strong and the resistance to difference is also so deeply ingrained that you would get tremendous amount of flack from being, different. But because difference can provide all kinds of psychological resilience, you know, training as a young person. So if you can get over that bump, I think you probably turn out to be a better person for it.
I think, Sharad, resilience perhaps could come a little bit later, but when you're in these tender years, you need confidence is a big issue. And children need to grow up with positive reinforcement and being teased by their friends because they're a little different at that point of time, it's not going to have that cause at all.
Well, you know, here I am speaking as somebody who's childless. So after these messages, the cure, just like heaven. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was the cure with Just Like Heaven. I'm sure I'd Kutin with me, Brian Fernandez. It's coming up to 22 minutes past 6 on the 8th of September. Of course, it's a Friday, which is cause for much celebration. Though in Disney, there's perhaps a bit of consternation and hand-wringing at this point in time because they're caught up in kind of bad publicity following a decision to create a white character in the live-action remake of Aladdin. And this is being termed and it's gone viral with the hashtag whitewashing. Now, perhaps this is something that's unique to American or British context in which, you know, being white is the kind of the dominant or the default mode in cultural terms. But there, of course, pushbacks in that, especially because of, I think, the aspirations to be multicultural and inclusive and have representation all around.
I think Hollywood has long been criticized for not being inclusive, Sharad. And this is, it's amazing that in this day and age, you're still having instances like this. I can't understand why they didn't put a casting out and put ethnically suitable characters or ethnically suitable actors only as one of the key criteria for auditioning for this role. So, yeah, I'm a supporter, you know, and against whitewashing of having white actors.
Well, looking at you, Brian, and looking at myself, I can see why we would naturally be inclined to be against whitewashing. But I must say, okay, let's put the other side, play the devil's advocate for a while. This, of course, is, you know, a fictional
character
in a fictional story about the world. It's, you know, it's run on the imaginations of people, right? And so if Disney decided that by putting a white character there, it will also help young people who identify with white characters, young males perhaps, in this case, this would just be more for everybody in the audience. It's not about taking everybody out, and it's not about whitewashing everybody, but it's creating an extra character, the character that wasn't perhaps in the original, and so why not? I mean, it's more rather than less.
Well, the thing is, so we have this picture that we've grown up with of Aladdin, right? Of certain characters because we are older.
So, yeah, sort of Arab.
Middle Eastern type person. So,
but you can see that even the Middle Eastern, what is the Middle Eastern type? It's such a range of phenotypes, skin color, hair, you know, straight or. I mean, look at the historical depiction of Jesus Christ, for instance. Yeah. I mean, they're the historical character. And, you know, and the depiction really is often very generally of Caucasian person rather than of somebody who's Semitic in character, right? Who's also Caucasian, but would have woolly hair and, you know, some maybe slightly
flowing
darker
robes. yes.
No, not that. Well, flowing robes is something you wear, yeah. But you know, in terms of your skin color, the shape of your nose and such. So the Semitic characters disappear in favor of more kind of European Caucasian looks.
No, no, fair enough. But in
not fair enough, Telly.
Fair or enough. Too, I mean, too, fair
too
enough.
Fair, too fair.
Too fair in this case. But one of the things it also brings up an issue of is in terms of employment of actors in Hollywood. Now, if you're not a white actor, where do you go and get roles from?
Yeah, so this is an interesting dimension to the story because, in fact, this particular movie has been caught up a lot of controversy, as, including the casting of the role of Princess Jasmine, which went to, as the story puts it, to a non-Arab actor, Naomi Scott. Now, Naomi Scott isn't... And so, you know, she was tagged initially white. She, in fact, is mixed. She's of white British and Indian heritage. And so her mother is Usha Scott. And you notice the name Usha there being of Indian origin. So, but so that becomes maybe, as you're kind of suggesting, really a fight about jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. Because in the past as well, in Hollywood, I think Asian American, I think, breaking the barriers to getting employed even was a big deal. But today, if even these roles are filled by white people, how are Asian American or ethnic American or ethnic actors as a whole able to penetrate that market? It's jobs for the boys. It's a closed shop.
Well, I think for Disney, the issue, of course, is also the audience and what the audience feels. If you're going into a production with, you know, popular sentiment against you and with the hashtag whitewashing, this is not good for a show, is it?
Yeah, and also don't forget, the world is now global. These productions are sold all around the world. So I don't buy that argument about having the white actor that is basically suitable for white audiences.
Okay, coming up next, we have Alex Turner and Pile Driver Waltz, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, where people don't get what they deserve. Yeah, well, some people do.
Some people don't. Yeah.
Okay, so that's Brian Fernandez. I'm Sharad Kutan. And it's just 40 minutes past 6 on the 8th of September. The morning run continues. Because remember, at any point in time, you can join the conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. That's our new number, 018-789-8899. Now, from the question of whitewashing, we go to the question of the Americanization of the English language. Now, this might not be upsetting to even Americans or most people in the world. Might be, of course, something that's upsetting people in jolly old England. Now, a book released this year claims that Americanisms have completely absorbed the English language by the year 2120. That's still quite a way off. That's about over 100 years from now. Matthew Engel's book, That's the Way It Crumbles, The American Conquest of English, was published recently. And it notes, among other things, the wireless or radio address made by Alistair Cook in 1935 when he declared that every Englishman listening to me now unconsciously uses 30 to 40 Americanisms a day. In 2017, the number is likely closer to 300 or 400, and Engels hazards and says that this would be perhaps even more so for teenagers, depending on how many words they actually use all day. Is this something that would concern you? I mean, the balance of Americanisms against, you know, the way in which British people speak the English language?
I think, okay, so it's all about, I think there's a point of view that says we should only speak Queen's English. And I used to subscribe to that view. You know, there's proper English and then there's American English. But I've changed my view because languages need to evolve and be alive. And so as part of that, especially among young people who are who absorb American pop culture, and that's been the case for decades, as American pop culture is absorbed by young people, Americanism then seeps into their day-to-day language.
So is there a difference between the way you speak the English language and say your daughter speaks the English language?
I think so, because YouTube has had a huge influence on that. You will find that because she goes and it's...
And do you ever correct her? Do you always try to pull her back to the way you were taught, using received pronunciation or standard, a slightly educated register of the English language as spoken by somebody who grows up in Britain?
Okay, so fortunately, her diction and syntax and punctuation, grammar, she's got a grandfather who has a master's degree in linguistics who corrects her, and so she speaks very good English.
Oh, so
better than me.
That's on your side or on your wife's side?
That's on my wife's side. My dad also used to be a journalist as well. So on both sides, she has very good coaches in terms of languages. So that's not probably an untypical child, but in general, you will find that...
Or atypical, I think.
Yes, but I think for the average child that doesn't have those benefits, Americanism has creeped into
way that they speak. Okay, what about in this part of the world, there's the question of the influence of American ways of speaking, and popular culture is a great conduit for that. But there's also this other thing about the localization, right? The Manglish, the Singlish. Now, would you allow your kid to do and use Manglish and Singlish expressions?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. So you're okay with the Americanization of the English language and her adoption of that, but you're not with the Manglish and English. And why is that?
So here's
you just said earlier that it's a living language. It's dynamic, and as long as people communicate, that's the most important thing.
Fair enough, but there's also proper grammar and syntax and punctuation which is so important.
So actually, grammar, the grammar, the syntax of sentences does in fact change depending on the kind of register you use, right? Because that's also part of the dynamics, not just particular words. It's not cookie versus biscuit. It's also the way in which you construct your sentences.
So you see, so what is you your, talk about sentence
are you
construction.
Holding, do you think you have a prejudice against Manglish?
Yes, I do, actually, because I think that we shouldn't mix languages together. Even when my command of Bahasa could be a lot better, and I'm always embarrassed that I have to find an English equivalent word to sometimes describe something. But I don't try to mix and mash it. I'll put up my hand and I don't pass it off as proper Bahasa Malaysia. So you shouldn't pass off English as Manglish.
You mean you shouldn't try and pass off
Manglish as English, yes, correct.
Well, but Manglish is just a different register of the English language, right? It might include the incorporation of non-English words, but the English language is full of non-English words.
Yeah, of course, because there's a lot of Latin-based...
Hindi words, Malay words in the English language. Amok, to run amok, it comes from the Malay word amok.
Ah, yes, that's right. Yeah, that's a good point.
So should, why that principle? So the principle of kind of keeping your language pristine, should that apply?
Well, I think in this case, you've got me there, Sharad.
Okay, Thunderclap Newman. Something in the air after these messages, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Brian Fernandez. And thank you very much to both SK or SK First Coffee, as well as D Club, I think is how you pronounce that Twitter handle. Both of them have weighed into the conversation about the English language. One asking if we are language purists and suggesting that if we were, we would be old school. And the other, who seems to have like a Cyrillic type font for their name, Manglish versus Malaysian English, the latter has legitimate grammar recognized by the Cambridge Board. So they say. So that's very interesting. We can go and check that out. And thank you very much for joining the conversation. Remember, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio, or you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. That's our new number. Now, looking at the news this morning and over the last week, we've noted that two men have been detained for allegedly uploading offensive remarks on Facebook about the Sultan of Johor, as well as the Crown Prince of Johor and the Johor Royal Institution. Johor Police Chief said that suspect, age 27, the first suspect, who's age 27, was detained, and the other suspect is age of 47, and both of them were detained. Now, the question really before us is, especially with regard to the Johor royalty, because many of these cases are where people have been taken in for, you know, making remarks that that insulted the royals, have been focused on the state of Johor, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, you see, Johor, both of us are from Johor, and I think
this is
true. And I can speak for myself. We've been told from young, we've been conditioned not to criticize the royalty, the monarchy, and so forth. But I think that's changed in terms of younger people, and social media has also probably allowed them to express themselves in
more
a manner
freely.
More freely.
So,
exactly.
So you have one person who is clearly not our generation, Brian, the 27-year-old, but also the 47-year-old, who's close,
exactly.
Close in age. In fact, it's probably your age, isn't
exactly.
It? Right. So, but the question is, you know, especially because the Johor royals have been very, you know, whether it is His Majesty, the Sultan of Johor, or it's been the Crown Prince and others, is that they're very involved in public culture, in the sense that they weigh in on matters of, you know, race relations, on development issues, you know, on their views on politicians. So they've come on, they've been very vocal, and they're part of that conversation. And so once you're part of that conversation, it seems that the perhaps, you know, the tolerance of a pushback, you know, people might not agree with you, right? So if you put yourself out there in the public realm, speaking about public matters or matters of public concern, then the question is, what hat are you using? And does that hat or crown, as it were, provide immunity from criticism?
And Sharad, that's a very good point, because they've tried to shape public opinion, especially in a very positive manner. When you talk about the need for diversity and inclusion, the Johor royals have come out and said a lot of positive things. But you're right. When you talk about different aspects of whether it's sports, whether it's politics, there is going to be some pushback. So therein lies the challenge then.
Yeah, you know, if you haven't already picked up that very slim but very powerfully written and cogently argued book, Ampun Tuanku by Zaid Ibrahim, you must, because it is a book that really explores the way to protect the institution of the royals and the royal houses and the royalty in our constitution, in our constitutional monarchy and democratic system. But it does, in fact, also put the onus on royals to behave in particular ways in order to protect the institution. So it's not just about the public that protects it, but the royals themselves have a role, which is not to extend or go beyond their constitutional powers. It also makes the argument that by not being involved in business, the royals stay above politics and the messiness of you know, of the everyday, which then also, again, protects them. But in the case of the Johor royals, we have them actively involved.
Very actively involved in business, yes. Very successfully, I might add. Obviously, also pushing the sports agenda tremendously as well. Doing very well. I'm very proud to say, you know, Johor Darul Taksim, best team in Malaysia. Champions League, I think Asian Champions League winner as well. So pushing the boundaries and the agenda.
Yeah, but going beyond, I think the question of the Johor royals and this particular instance, there is the question of royalty around the world, right? It's, as an institution, it's diminishing. Remember, just in the last decade or so, we had the end of several royal, at least one royal house that I can remember, which is the Nepal royals. Remember, the Nepal went from being a constitutional monarchy to being a republic, and that's happened. So over the last couple of hundred years, what was the dominant form of government has now become a minority, and most of them don't in fact have any executive power. There are very few countries in the world where the royals have executive power, and the question is whether that system on balance has had benefits. You know, we have assumed that it doesn't, that we want to move away from this kind of feudal order, but there might be those who advocate you know, this as a good thing, that on balance, you know, royals come with a very different thinking than those politicians who are there because of the vote.
I think that's probably going to be a subject of a separate discussion that will take far longer than this particular talk set.
Yeah. So now we have the Beatles and Norwegian Wood to save us. BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez, and the Morning Run continues. Coming up to 7 minutes past seven, it is the 8th of September, and a very interesting day when BFM is actually giving away prizes. Now, if you spot the big furious machine, it's a Volvo truck, which will be cruising along major highways in the Klang Valley, starting 10 a.m. this morning up to 5:30 in the evening. And if it's safe, take a picture and post it on any of BFM's social media sites, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, and win yourself some prizes. But make sure to tag us at BFM Radio and include the hashtag BFM Volvo. That's hashtag BFM Volvo. Continue tuning in to us as we bring you live updates about the truck's whereabouts. And take a, you know, use this opportunity to take a selfie with it. I don't know what a Volvo truck looks like, Brian. Do you?
No, but Sharad, did you see that cool ad, the cool with Jean-Claude Van Damme, where he's basically doing splits in between two trucks? If you haven't seen this...
Is that a Volvo? Is that
yes,
a Volvo
that's
a,
those are Volvo, Volvo ads. Go into YouTube, take a look at that. It's an amazing video.
Okay. And also, there's a wonderful little... I'm not a big fan of Jean-Claude Van Damme, but there's a JCVD. That's the name of a movie, and it stars him as him. Very poignant and very clever movie, I must say. Now, civil liberties lawyer Sharizan Johan says that the Pakatan Harapan coalition should be wary of young people joining the political parties in the coalition with hidden motives. According to him, and I quote him, after 2013, I saw there was a group of youngsters who joined political parties believing there are positions they can fill. And he said this at a public forum. The forum was called Change the Government or Change the Youth. It also featured Pakatan Harapan youth leaders who rebutted Sharizan's assertion that their political positions had been bestowed upon them with privileges. So we spoke to Sharizan Johan because it's a bit of a storm in a teacup, a storm in a Pakatan teacup, and asked him whether it was realistic to expect people in power to be angelic.
I wouldn't assume. I'm just voicing out the concerns. I'm signaling the alarm bells for especially the opposition parties, that there are people who are joining their ranks for the wrong reasons. I think this cuts across the board. It used to be prevalent in perhaps the Barisan National Party simply because they have been in power for so long. But we are also seeing the same thing happening in parties in Pakatan Harapan as well as PAS. And I'm not generalizing. I'm saying that there are, of course, certainly there's a lot of people who do join politics even after 2013 for the right reason, because they actually believe in the cause and so on and so forth. But we have seen it, young people suddenly with titles or with wealth because of certain positions, sometimes without even positions, but because they are affiliated to some people. So we have seen that. Political parties, especially the opposition, because, you know, they're trying to put themselves out there as different from the Barisan. So they have got to make sure that these elements within their ranks are kept in check and taken care of, or else people are going to have the perception that there's actually no difference between the two coalitions. I mean, hearing what my fellow panelists have said yesterday, I think there are real difficulties that those who really believe in the cause have to go through, you know, funding and so on and so forth, especially if they are working in places where they're not in power.
And now we also asked him to tell us if he had any practical suggestions about how to keep people with less than, you know, honourable intentions out of politics.
I think in the first instance, of course, some sort of internal asset declaration would be useful. A public asset declaration is, of course, the ideal situation. But if they're not prepared to do that, at least an internal mechanism in which these people periodically have to declare their assets. The disciplinary wings or disciplinary portions of these political parties need to be, I think, proactive as well to see which members are suddenly found with a lot of wealth and suddenly have changed their lifestyle and so on and so forth. And I think the most important thing is not how political parties weed out these unsavory elements, but actually how we as a people must watch out for politicians, whether they are young or old, who previously, compared to their previous situation, have suddenly been found with newfound wealth or luxuries, which can only be attributed with their affiliations with governments, be it federal or state governments.
That was Sharizan Johan. Speaking about a very real problem about people who join politics for reasons that are less than, less than savory.
But Sharad, for me, it doesn't seem like an issue at all in some ways, and I've got to take the view of that, because that happens globally around the world with politicians. I don't have a particularly high opinion of politicians in general. But you see that, it's whether from Zimbabwe to the UK to Australia, politicians don't become politicians to
merely
save the world.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true, but I think there is a kind of internal contradiction, right? People join politics to change at least the government, and they should be ambitious enough to want to change that situation and to take power. So when you start to accuse people of being power hungry in the system, you know, and within this ecosystem, it's a kind of curious charge to make, because that's precisely what they should be, wanting. In fact, it used to be the problem with politics in this country is that people join politics to always ever be in opposition. It was almost a kind of somewhat cynical, somewhat resigned, defeatist attitude that people had when they joined the federal opposition, right? They never thought they could achieve power. But when people who join politics stop thinking they're going to take power, then they stop being practical as well. And I think it's important to see yourself, or at least imagine yourself, if you're not in power, that one day you will come to power, and that might actually moderate your views. That might actually make you a person much more given to aggregating the different interests and demands of various parts of your constituency, rather than just being a kind of one cause and somewhat shrill politician.
Yeah, because what happens is, if you go in with a mandate of just championing one cause, what happens is that cause is then either solved or the needs of the electorate change. You have nothing to fight for. You have no issues. You have no reason for being.
Right. And I think the other interesting thing that Sharizan brought up is the idea of differentiation between the coalitions, right? Each coalition is trying to, suggest that they are special and unique, and they bring something to the table that the other doesn't. And it used to be that, those in the federal opposition, before they achieved power, would say, well, we're not corrupt like those other guys. But of course, we've had instances of corruption on the Pakatan side as well, and, some quite famous ones in this year. So this is a problem for all coalitions, anybody who's going to achieve power. The question is, and if you remember that Breakfast Grill we did, and you can still download that, it's podcasted, of course. The question is whether the youth are really the ones who are going to be carrying the mantle for political change, or is it just anybody with good sense?
Well, the thing is, I think idealism and the willingness to do good starts with the youth always. You come in with charged up with ideals.
Oh, really? Do you think so?
I think so. I think when you get a little bit older and you go into politics, perhaps you're still you're a little bit jaded already.
Oh, I don't know about that. Maybe you're just more you're wiser and even tempered and more sensible. I'm not one to just, cheerlead the millennials on. I think millennials should keep in their place. I'm just being ironic there. Okay, we'll be back with more news and analysis after this. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.